Okay, well, tonight I am going to continue the series that we've been in the middle of. Many of you have been coming for these sits over the last few weeks. I think Brian started them at the beginning of, was it January?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Where we're looking at the Four Noble Truths and some of the basic foundations of Buddhism as a Sangha. And so, just to review, we've talked about suffering. The first noble truth is that there is suffering, and just being aware of suffering. Second noble truth is that there are causes to suffering, and at the root of suffering is ignorance and grasping, wanting things to be different than the way that they are. The third noble truth, there's a cessation to suffering, that freedom is possible. And the fourth noble truth is also called the Noble Eightfold Path, and that's the way leading to the cessation of suffering. And so I got to begin this noble, the kind of journey together in the Noble Eightfold Path last week by looking at right or wise view. And today I'll also keep within this wisdom group and look at right or wise intention. So last week I mentioned that wise view is like looking at a roadmap as you're preparing to travel somewhere. And without a sense of where you're going and a sense of the big picture, it's easy to get lost and confused. So it helps to know the big picture and cultivate this wise view. The second is wise intention. And I interchange right and wise together. And as I talked about last week, part of the reason for that is that typically we translate the Buddha's words into right, right view, right intention, but sometimes that gives the sense that there's one right way, and that's not what we're talking about. So some teachers like to use the language of the wisdom, that there's wise ways, and there's more than one. It's not just one way of looking, but that these are the teachings of the Buddha as we explore this. So wise intention, we have the map as wise view. Wise intention is the direction that we're looking in. So it's like looking at the map and saying, I want to head to New York, and then turning in that direction. So this is a turning, this is a practice in turning, setting intention and turning toward that in that direction. So if you don't have a clear intention, you're likely to meander around and never make it to where you're heading. So it helps to have a sense of direction. But it's not a rigid sense of direction. It can be very fluid. And there's lots of different metaphors that help us think about what's meant by this intention. One of the ones I like a lot is by Thich Nhat Hanh, the Vietnamese Zen master, who uses the metaphor of watering the seeds. You can water the seeds of happiness, kindness, and well-being, or you can water the seeds of greed, ill will, and delusion. And the seeds that you water are sort of the intentions that you set. So we have these subconscious intentions, these kind of unconscious patterns that effectively water the more negative seeds, and we can set conscious intentions to water the seeds of what we want to experience in the world. Now the Buddha teaches that right intention has three key dimensions, and that's the intention of renunciation, which counteracts desire and greed, the intention of goodwill, which counteracts ill will, and the intention of harmlessness, which counteracts harmfulness. And I'm going to go through each of these, of the Buddha's intentions, and hopefully help to make them relevant for what we experience in our day-to-day lives as lay people. So we'll begin with renunciation. So renunciation, right? It sounds like a strange word to our modern ears. Kind of evokes these images of strictness, austerity, and sternness. A renunciate is someone who abandons the pursuit of material comforts in order to achieve spiritual enlightenment. Is this an enlightenment or awakening to the true nature of existence out of reach for us moderns, and for us lay people, us non-renunciates, who sit here in warmth, with cushions, probably well-fed, and are we being called to like renounce material comfort as lay people when we consider this as a major Buddhist intention? Well, another way of thinking about renunciation is, while it can mean giving up all material comforts, and that's particularly true for monks, it can also be thought of as simply letting go. When we renunciate something, we let go. We're letting go. So as lay people, we're talking about giving up all material, we're not talking about giving up all material comforts. And going to live maybe in a cave. That's some of the imagery that might come up for you when you hear the word renunciation. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about renunciating or letting go of our attachments. And so you often hear this theme come up in Buddhism about that we suffer when we're grasping, when we're holding on, and when we're attached. And it's in the release and the letting go and the renunciation of our attachments that freedom becomes possible. So this is a direction, this is an intention that we can turn in. But why attachments, right? I think the main sense that we focus on these attachments is that they're transient, that what we're attaching onto are maybe thoughts, feelings, emotions, sensations. All of these experiences, perceptions, are transient, and so they change. And when we're grasping onto them, when we're not wanting to let go of them, that's what creates the suffering, because they're inevitably going to change. So when we attach to anything, whether it be material possessions, thoughts, physical states, or any so forth, we try to control and fix things. And so we only suffer when change inevitably arrives. So there's this story that I love that illustrates this letting go of attachments. And it's a story that's told about Ajahn Chah, the Thai Buddhist forest monk, who is the a lot of the teachers of kind of modern Buddhism here in America learned under Ajahn Chah, and they talk about him very fondly. And they tell these stories about Ajahn Chah always drinking from his favorite cup of tea. And he loved this favorite cup, this glass that he was always found, apparently, with this cup, this teacup. And one day a student kind of called him on this, and he said, you know, something to the effect of, you know, why are you always with this cup? This doesn't make any sense. You seem very attached to this cup. You're always teaching us about non-attachment, but we always find you drinking from this cup. And Ajahn Chah replied something like, it is true. I do enjoy this drinking glass. I like the way it holds my tea. I admire the way the sun shines off it, at times creating tiny rainbows. This is my favorite glass. But I do not cling to it, because to me, this glass is already broken. I know that my time with it is temporary and precious, so I enjoy this glass while it lasts, but I'm fully aware that eventually it will fall from the shelf or be knocked over and shattered. And when that happens, I will say, of course. So you can maybe think about something you feel attached to. I've had favorite mugs, and this story has kind of helped me to realize that it's the moment. In the moment, in this moment, I can delight in that mug. But it's not a mug forever. It's not going to last forever. Eventually, it will break. And the idea is that we're setting the intention of not holding on to too tightly, that we can hold it. We can hold this cup and we can enjoy it. But we have a light grasp. We have a light, not even grasp isn't the right word. We just have a light, gentle hold on the things in our lives. Or Jack Kornfield talks about Ajahn Chah as often people would ask him questions. They were trying to solve their problems in life. They'd come to Ajahn Chah with this wise old monk wanting their problem solved. They'd ask him some type of impossible question, and he would just answer, "Oh, it's uncertain, isn't it?" So, that's a good one. I want to use that sometime. It's uncertain. So, the Bhagavad Gita alludes to this. Actually, one of the central messages in the Bhagavad Gita is to act well without attachment to the fruit of your actions. So, we can act well, we can set strong intentions, but we don't have expectations, and so we're not grasping onto a future. That's not happening. That's not now. We're gently holding, and we're gently holding on in the present moment to whatever it is, and we can enjoy that which is in our lives. So we can set an intention to let go and experience the liberating results when we set such a clear intention. And at the end of the talk, toward the end of the talk, I'll start mentioning a little bit more about setting these types of intentions and how they can help liberate us and the power of setting intentions in our lives and in our practice. So, the second major intention of the Buddha's teaching is the intention of goodwill. So, goodwill is synonymous with metta, the loving kindness practice that we practice in this group every Monday night at the end of a sit. It's the wish for others to be happy and free. And setting the intention of goodwill or kindness or wishes of well-being for all is considered an antidote to the poisons of greed, ill will, and delusion. So, Akaraya Buddha Rakita, who is a contemporary Buddhist monk from India, and he died a few years ago, he had this to say about metta that I think is really powerful. Metta makes one a pure font of well-being and safety for others. Just as a mother gives her own life to protect her child, so metta only gives and never wants anything in return. To promote one's own interest is a primordial motivation of human nature. When this urge is transformed into the desire to promote the interest and happiness of others, not only is the basic urge of self-seeking overcome, but the mind becomes universal by identifying its own interest with the interests of all. By making this change, one also promotes one's own well-being in the best possible manner. So we can hear many themes in this particular quote, one of them being universal love. And I think it's really important to point out that when we're talking about metta or loving kindness, it doesn't mean one particular type of love. Like, it doesn't mean that I have to love every single person in the same way. It means that we're loving people and other beings in ways that create no harm. It's finding the right expression of love. It's not a love that hurts. So I'll offer a recent example. In my life, I have a friend who was being really accused of being unspiritual because she wasn't willing to have an open marriage. And I find this to be really a distortion of spirituality and what's being taught about love. That this is not a love that's the same for everybody. So this is the key, and it's a love that creates no harm. This is warmth, kindness, non-harm, or even can be just thought of as friendliness. So there's a story of the Buddha's disciples being overcome with fear from these tree deities. The story goes that something like these monks were meditating in the forest close to where the Buddha was, and the tree deities started getting angry at them because they felt like they were taking over their trees. And so the Buddha they went to the Buddha very concerned and afraid, and the Buddha gave them a protection, which is called metta. It was this metta practice. And it said that the deities felt the warmth and kindness that were generated from the monks, and they relaxed and they stopped terrifying the monks. But you can see that when you bring true warmth and kindness into situations, sometimes things start to relax. You might be in a challenging or difficult situation, and then you bring genuine kindness and understanding, warmth and goodwill, and there's a shift. So the Buddha has a blessing that he shared. This is the blessing of metta. Monks, when universal love leading to liberation of mind is ardently practiced, developed, unrelentingly resorted to, used as one's vehicle, made the foundation of one's life, fully established, well consolidated, and perfected, then these 11 blessings may be expected. What 11? One sleeps happily. One wakes happily. One does not suffer bad dreams. One is dear to human beings. One is dear to non-human beings. The gods protect one. No fire or poison or weapon harms one. One's mind gets quickly concentrated. The expression of one's face is serene. One dies unperturbed. And even if one fails to attain higher states, one will at least reach the state of the Brahma world. So that's a big promise, big blessings there. But there's a power. Those of you who've practiced metta and have done so for maybe long stretches of time begin to start to feel the power of metta. And of course, this is all experiential. We start to experience things in a different way. And so we can apply this in our own lives today. When you generate warmth toward others who might wish you harm, you can transform that harm. That can shift. So I have another example of a friend. This is a different friend who she was out walking about maybe early evening on the streets in her neighborhood, and a drunk man started stumbling toward her, looking quite threatening. And she just generated a pure loving kindness and showed genuine concern for his well-being and said, you know, brother, are you okay? Do you need help? And this sort of disarmed this person. He kind of looked a little bit confused, and he staggered off, kind of like just confused by what had just happened. But there was a power here that was generated, and it was just generated in the moment authentically. And I've seen some really interesting shifts in my own life with the power of metta and loving kindness. Many years ago, I had heard that the Dalai Lama, when asked what his religion was, he said his religion was the religion of kindness. And that was a huge revelation to me. It opened up, just hearing that opened up amazing doors. I think at the time I had a lot of social anxiety. I'm an introvert by nature. I was pretty shy. And here I am in many, many public settings, having to interact with many, many, many people. And if you're an introvert, you know that that can be challenging. And so I was never really always at ease in those situations. When I heard about the Dalai Lama just generating kindness, I realized, oh, that's all I have to do. I just need to be kind. Like, that's it. I don't need to be clever or meet some expectation that I can't meet or be anything other than I am. I just need to be kind. And that kindness has really been transformative. So the intention to generate kindness has been a really powerful intention in my experience, and it has these kind of rippling effects. So again, we set these intentions, but free from attachment. So we don't expect particular results. I remember when I was experimenting with some of these type of intentions, there was a colleague who was particularly challenging to work with, and I had this idea that if I brought cookies to the meeting, that would just like change everything. And no, it didn't. It was more of a manipulation on my part, thinking, oh, I'm gonna change her. And so that's not where this is coming from. This is a practice that's coming from a genuine, authentic interest in the alleviation of suffering for all beings, without attachment, free from attachment, that we don't know what the results will be. So finally, the third is the intention of non-harming. And in the most direct way, this means not killing any animal or other living creatures. And this intention is based on the understanding that all sentient beings experience suffering and want to live. So when asked what the Dalai Lama thought about swatting mosquitoes, he said, if he's in a good mood, he'll let them have a little of his blood. But if another comes and he becomes a little impatient, he'll blow it off his arm. And if a third mosquito comes, he's more likely to give it a careful little shove off of his arm. But you can hear the intention of non-harming behind it, that there's a deep intention of non-harming, even if he gets, you know, disturbed by that. So we set an intention not to harm, but sometimes harm is unavoidable. And there's scripture in the Buddhist text about self-protection. There's also discussion about eating meat if it's offered. So everything in the Buddhist orientation is thought of in terms of a balanced perspective. And some harm is inevitable. We're surrounded by microorganisms who live on and within us. And even these little beings seek life. Everything seeks life. So the intention is non-harm. But if I scratch my skin, there's death. If I walk across, you know, the ground, death is happening. And it's happening in and on us and around us. And some religions go pretty extreme measures not to even harm microorganisms. Understand that there's some religions that try to wear face masks so that they're not breathing in the microorganisms because they're concerned about killing them. But again, the Buddhist focus is on intention as well as balance. So we exercise all reasonable measures to avoid harming and killing. But we also recognize that we're part of an intricate web of being, and that our very ability to live implies that others die. Or, you know, just like I said, scratching our skin, taking a walk, eating a meal, all implies harm and death. So, with intention, we aim. We're aiming in a particular direction. We aim in these three directions. But we might also consider the power of setting very specific intentions that can relate to our own lives. So I have some intention practices that have really been powerful in my life that I thought I would share with you today. One of them is that on the solstice, for me it's on the summer solstice, for my husband it's on the winter solstice, we set an intention for the whole year. And so, and that's been going on for the last 12 years. So I've had these like large, big intentions each year that sort of swim in my experience. And it's very interesting to see how they play out, because I'm aiming in a particular direction and it's having effect on my experience. But I also set intentions with the lunar cycle. So I have two friends who I call my moon sisters, and we set these intentions together on the full moon. And so this lunar cycle, I've been doing this for about 6 years now, and this lunar cycle, my intention has been nourishing my relationships. And it's just interesting to see how they play out when we set these intentions. One lunar cycle, I set an intention to have an inner namaste every time I encountered my children, because I wasn't really interacting all that great with them. They were maybe driving me a little bit crazy. So I set the intention of an inner namaste, just the spirit within me bows to the spirit within you, is the translation of namaste. And so every time I see them, the intention helped me see in a particular way. So I was seeing their more like children of the universe, not, you know, the types of behaviors that were irritating me. That's not what I was looking for. And because I was looking in this particular different direction, it had a really powerful effect, not one that I could have predicted or that I was looking for, but it shifted my whole entire interaction with my son, which at that time was just spiraling downward fast. And he was responding to my energy or something about the way that I was greeting him and being with him that shifted the dynamic. So these intentions can be incredibly powerful, and we can get really creative with them. You know, I've learned over the years that there's all sorts of ways that we can set intentions that will help us to foster non-harm or clarity of seeing or deepening of our practice or like right now my nourishing my friendships is very important, and so I'm able to like create these intentions and they have their effects. And so there's a ritual aspect to setting intentions that's been helpful. So the ritual being like with the full moon or with the solstice, the cycles of nature, or something that you can, that happens regularly so that you can connect with it. And just watch the power of the intentions as they unfold. So I just want to end with this realization that at the heart of right intention is cultivating a particular quality of mind. This is the key. It's not to gain some sort of, you know, positive result, but it's cultivating a quality of mind. It's a mind that does not hold on too tight, but is able to see the inherent quality of impermanence and change in everything, and so holds all experience with gentleness and ease. And this is a quality of mind through right intention that generates friendliness and kindness. And finally, this is a quality of mind that wishes for the well-being of all sentient beings. So this is a compassionate mind that seeks to alleviate suffering wherever it is found. Okay, so let's take a few moments to stretch out.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.